Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome. It's our bonus Q&A episode of Books of the Year with the fabulous John Boyne, the international best-selling author. Correct?
Well, it is correct.
Yes.
I mean, you can roll your eyes all you like, John, but it's true.
Yes. Best-selling, yes. Well, international, yes. Yes. Author, yes.
Yes, so I'll take all of that.
Okay. So in our previous podcast, hopefully you heard John talking about his new book, Water, the start of a... In movie land, they do talk about quadrilogies, but I kind of think this is a clumsy word.
Yeah, I think a quartet.
Quartet word.
It does feel better. Okay, Q&A then. You've answered these questions before, but each time you get a different answer.
Yeah.
Particularly when the opening question is, what is the last book that you really, really enjoyed reading?
Okay, well, I gave this one a lot of thought. And I look, because I keep a list of all the books that I read. And the book, I suppose, enjoyed will be it'd be a strange word to use about this. The book that had the biggest impression on me, I think, quite some years, was a book published this year. It's called 17 by a guy called Joe Gibson. And it's a nonfiction book, which is unusual for me because I don't read very much nonfiction. One of my New Year's resolutions every year is to read more, and I always fail. But it came out this year, and it's about a guy. He's telling his story now from, I think he's in his 40s, but he's looking back to when he was 17 and in school, and he was groomed by his female teacher. And they had it would be wrong to say they had a relationship. He was abused by her for many years, and it had a very, very powerful and unhappy effect on his life. And it's one of those stories that I think men and boys would often look at and go stupidly, would say, oh, you know, if the teacher missed whatever in school I was, you know, lusting after, I would have been thrilled. But it's not that simple. It's exactly the same as a male teacher abusing a female child. It's it can have a really, really traumatic effect. And that book has really, really stayed with me since I read it about 8-9 months ago. As I say, enjoyed would be the wrong word, but in terms of an emotional reaction to a book, which is what I always want. I want to be moved by it. That's the one that got me the most
And did it feed in? Was there some way in which that fed your anger or your fury or your creativity to write the quad?
No, I had already, I was already, I think, on book three, excuse me, by the time I read that. But one of the, I suppose it brought me back to a lot of my books in the way that in Joe Gibson's book, he talks about the fact that so many teachers in the school knew this was going on, knew about this, that she was, you know, abusing this boy. And because he was one of the boys that they expected to go to Oxford or Cambridge, and that was going to be a big deal for the school, they just turned the other way. And, you know, it's just one of those things that just baffles you.
It's interesting because you say you were in the middle of writing that third book, which, as you've said, that third book is from the point of view of the abuser.
Yeah.
And your decision to pick up this book, because there will be some writers who go, actually, I don't want to be anywhere near reading someone else's take on this because I want it to be entirely mine. So it's interesting that you decided, no, I do want to read this now.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty good at separating what I'm reading from what I'm writing. And I do know writers, for example, who, if they're writing a first-person novel, can't read a first-person novel, and same with the third and so on. But I don't seem to have that problem in any way. I'm able to just sort of put the two aside.
How many books do you tend to read a month? And I'd be more interested in ones that you're reading for you as opposed to ones that you're reading for research.
I always aim to read about 100 books a year. So if it's 100 books a year, that's about,
wow.
You know,
okay.
Eight a month. I'm lucky because other than writing, I don't have another job. So I'm at home when I'm not like away on book tours or whatever, I'm at home, I'm writing during the day, but I see reading as part of my day and my job. So I get through about two books a week on average, I would say, depending on the length of the book. But I generally try to get to about 100. And I know I'm at, this is, you know, early November, and I know I'm at something like 84.
So you're keeping
count? I keep a list. I keep a list for years.
Okay.
I'm a very OCD kind of person. I have that in common with David Beckham, apparently. You know, I have everything, you know.
You and David,
we get mixed up for each other quite a lot, actually.
Do you ever, just on that, and we're off on a tangent here, but I heard the historian Simon Sebag Montefiore on a podcast last week. And in the course of the conversation, he talked about his book, which is called Jerusalem, which is like a biography of the city of Jerusalem. And he talked about it in such an interesting way. I got home and I bought the book and it's arrived and it's massive. You know, it's bigger than a Terry Hayes book. But I have started, and I'm sort of being blown off course, my reading plan, by the world events. You know, does the world ever get to a particular point and you think, actually, I know nothing about that. I need to read about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of things that, for example, I really am very, very badly informed on the whole Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I'm trying to inform myself at the moment by, you know, reading different newspapers, different takes on it, because I don't know that much. And strangely, I remember years ago, when we were doing the movie tour of Striped Pyjamas in the States, and this was the only place this happened, every American journalist who spoke to me asked me about that subject. And I always said, you know, look, I'm sorry, it's just, I don't know anything about this. And anything I say will be very unhelpful, which I think was the wise thing to do. But right now, that's the subject that I'm trying to educate myself a bit on. Yeah.
Guess what? It's okay not to share your views about everything online.
Yeah.
Short chapters versus long chapters, discuss.
Short. I learned a big lesson when I was writing Hearts Invisible Furies, which is the long book, as I say, longer than Moby Dick. And that book has 10 chapters that are, you know, every 7 years. But I decided each chapter, because they would be quite long, they'd be about 20,000 words, divide them into just these little mini sections. So there's like 3 or 4 pages a piece. And I like that as a reader and a writer, because if you're enjoying it, you might say, oh, I haven't the energy to read sort of, you know, 50 more pages to get to the end of the chapter. But I'll read another little 3 pages of the mini chapter.
Yes.
And before you know it, you might read all of them and keep going. And as a writer, I find when I'm editing, when I'm in the second, third, fourth, fifth drafts of a book, short chapters are, for me, easier to work on. There, you know, you can isolate them and try to make them as perfect as possible.
I'm a big fan of short. There's a horse racing book that I read, and I'm not into horse racing at all, but I read this summer, as written by an American writer, Catherine Scanlon, and some of the chapters are literally one sentence, and none of them are more than 4 or 5 pages. And as a consequence, you find yourself ripping through the book because it's so straightforward.
I also have this dread of, you know, when you turn a page in a book and all you see is 2 big blocks of text. And no matter how good the book is, my heart sort of sinks. You know, it's like the writer being just deliberately awkward.
You need to be able to look at a page and go, that's my out point. I can, you know, I'm still engaged and I can stay, but that's the outdoor. If I need to leave at that point, I'll get to a page and a half and then I'm off.
Do you work best to deadlines? Do they sort of they help you write?
I don't really worry about deadlines at all, because I'm pretty prolific, clearly, as a writer. You know, I write a lot. I really enjoy it. I have deadlines in my book contracts, but I never really think about them. You know, when I say to my editor, I'll probably be able to deliver this book by such and such a date, I say that realistically, and I know that I will. But I never really get to a place where I'm thinking, oh gosh, you know, it's 3 weeks away and I haven't got there yet. I've 30,000 words yet to write. I haven't got to that. So I'm okay with that, actually.
So it feels like deadlines don't figure for you at all. Then,
I don't really think about them. Yeah.
No.
So
very jealous of John. we always like to surprise our guests with a voice note and a question. In fact, you've been one of these questions.
Yeah.
So we have a question from a fellow Irish writer for you.
Hi, John. This is Donal Ryan. As you know, I'm a huge fan of yours. You're a constant inspiration as a writer and as a human being. And my question to you is around stamina. How do you maintain your energy and inspiration year after year, turning out work of such high quality?
Oh, that's lovely. I love Donald. He's great. Who also writes short books.
Very good.
Yeah,
God bless him.
Short books. So stamina. I think a lot of it comes from the fact that I genuinely love what I do. You know, I'm not one of those writers who says, I hate writing, I wish I didn't have to write. When I read those interviews, you know, I just think, oh, then don't. You know, the world isn't going to fall apart if you don't write another book. I'm 23 years publishing novels, and I get as much excitement from it as I ever did. And it feeds me in some way. So I think that's where the stamina comes from just actually loving the craft of it and knowing that I'm very fortunate to have the opportunity to publish books.
So given that you love it, do you have to stop yourself writing then? Because there are some people who will go, I'm going to give myself 4 hours in the morning, write, but then I've done my 4 hours. It sounds with you like you would actually have to stop yourself writing because you're enjoying it so much.
Well, no, I mean, like, there's certainly days where, you know, it's harder than other days. But the way I work is I don't really say to myself in the morning, right, I've got to write for 4 hours. I look at it by the end of the day that I want to have achieved something with the day. So I'm usually at my desk by about 8:30. I'll do a little bit, then I'll, you know, read something, then I'll, you know, do the laundry, whatever, you know, just normal things. And then I'll go back in, I'll do another hour maybe, go out and do other things. And just really over the course of the day, it's not sort of a word count or how many hours. It's just to feel at the end of the day, I didn't waste time, that for the most part, I've achieved something with my day.
So if you hadn't become a writer, John, what profession would we find you in now if it weren't writing?
I think I would have liked to have been an actor. And when I was in school, I was very shy, very introverted, and I didn't have the courage really to take part in plays and so on. But I love now being on stages. I think there is a showman somewhere inside me. And when I'm at literary festivals, and I guess, you know, you hone it over the years, you hone your sort of shtick on stage with mm-hmm. as a writer, the stories you tell, the jokes you tell. And I really, I know when it's working, when the audience are enjoying what I'm saying and I'm sort of feeding off them. And there is this part of me still thinks, you know, maybe I'm not too old. Maybe like if an opportunity in my life came up to be in a play, I would seize it with both hands.
Really?
Yeah, right. I absolutely would. I might be absolutely hopeless at it, but I'd give it a shot for sure.
Do you remember the first book that you bought with your own money?
I do. It was a series of books and it was The Secret Seven. I wasn't into The Famous Five.
Okay.
The Famous Five, I found those books, weirdly, I found them too long. The Secret Seven books were shorter. And I was obsessed with The Secret Seven. And when I was about, I don't know, 7 or 8 and started saving some of my pocket money to buy books, I wanted to have the full set of The Secret Seven. And eventually did by the time I grew out of them. And I think they're still, I think my mum still has them in a wardrobe at home somewhere, these old books. I didn't buy that many books as a kid. You know, we used the library pretty much all the time. And the only times I really bought books is when we were going on our summer holidays. And then my parents would let us go to the bookshop and buy 3 books and you had to choose those carefully. But Secret Seven was the ones I
remember. Has it remained important, or is it just one of those kind of childish things that you can put away?
The Secret Seven?
Mm-hmm.
No, it probably hasn't remained important to me now. I haven't gone back and read them or anything. But, you know, Enid Blyton was a terrific writer. And so many of us probably, you know, read her books as a kid. You know, the first thing I really remember about books is Noddy. And I had a little Noddy outfit when I was 4. I just loved it. I loved that outfit. I used to wear it constantly. I mean, my mom used to, like, to... For her to wash it, she'd have to literally sedate me or something to get this. And I had a little hat with the bell.
Yeah?
No.
Yeah.
Really? I remember reading some of the Enid Blyton Famous Five to my kids first one. And, you know, you collect the set and all that kind of stuff. And there's that moment where you realize that you are going to have to do a little bit of editing yourself as you're reading them out, because otherwise, you know, the gypsy boy that comes into town with the circus, it's always him.
Yeah.
You know, if there's something bad that's happened, he's the guy. Yeah. It's like, it's, you know, fingers pointing. This is the guy. That
you can't trust. Yeah.
So you just have to change things around.
You know, I recently read a biography of Agatha Christie, and I love Agatha Christie books, but similarly, If there's a foreigner in the book, you can pretty much rely on the foreigner to have done it.
Can I ask you, and I'm seriously not trying to get you into any kind of trouble, what do you think about books that are being, because this has very much been a topic this year and last year, about books where there are, for historical reasons, there are problems with the text that you're looking at. So are you looking at it with eyes from the 21st century and you're looking at thinking, okay, this feels a little bit clumsy, whatever, or inappropriate, and they are rewritten. Do you think that's a good idea for publishers to be getting their hands in that, or do you instinctively think that's a mistake?
I think it is sacrilege to do that. I think books represent their time and their place. Sure, there will be words in certain books that we would not use today and that we might not want to say aloud if we're reading it to a young person, but that's what was written at the time and we learned from that. And what happens if we just keep rewriting it? Eventually, you know, the next generation rewrite it again and the next again. Before you know it, it's how much of it was the original book at all? There's so many books in the world. If you don't want to read one that you think is going to be offensive to your sensibilities, read something else.
We're always intrigued, John, by people's bookshelves at home and how they order them or don't. And we've had people say they order them. I order mine by fiction, non-fiction. So basically, on a shelf with non-fiction, it's only going to be non-fiction. And we've had people saying alphabetical. We've had people saying colour, which feels like a lot of work whenever you buy a new book. Do you have a system? Do you not have a system?
I do have a system.
Oh, right.
And I wonder, is this a system that you've ever had a guest have before? Because I think it's kind of unique. I mentioned that I have sort of, I'm a little bit OCD on these things. So I know in my book, I have about 3,000, in my house, I have about 3,000 books. And the trick is to be able to find the book that you want without any difficulty. But also, my worry always about if I went just A to Z around the house is that, you know, if you buy a new book by John Banville, you know, so that's a B, you have to put that in and then move everything around. So I came up with a system. My system is geography. Okay?
Okay.
So, for example, in my living room, there's all the Irish literature, alphabetical by author and then chronological by book within author. In my front office in the house, it's all my British literature. There's a room upstairs which has Australia and New Zealand. There's a above a staircase is all the Americans. There's a Canadian section. There's a translated literature section. There's international literature written in English that does not fulfill any of the previous characteristics. I kid you not. And I can find what I want that way. There's a non-fiction section, and even that is then broken up into, you know, certain.
It's like going into Daunt's, the bookshop.
It's superb, you know, where
you,
I love it.
Where
yeah.
you can clearly see which sections. Yeah. That's. I want to come round to your house.
Sense.
I want to be shown
yeah,
round.
You'd be very welcome. It makes sense. And a few years ago, actually, I did a piece for the Irish Times where I went to 5 Irish writers' houses to see how they did their shelves. And they all had different ways of doing it, but I set them each a task. I would find a book in the house and then time them to see how long it took them to find it. Because if they can't find it, well, then your shelves aren't working. And if you can find it quickly, you can. So that's how I do it. Geography. Has anybody ever done that before?
No. You are the first. Wow, that's superb.
Absolutely.
Geography. Color is crazy. I mean, that's just nuts. I don't know. I've seen things in newspapers and magazines say where some... I'm pretty sure Tom Rob Smith... I'm pretty sure I saw an interview with him where he has his books color-coded.
I wouldn't be able to remember what colour a book... Anthony Horowitz, what colour is that? I don't know. I've got no idea.
Yeah.
You know. Anyway, you could never find that book. Anyway, so here we go then. You're throwing a fantasy dinner party, John. Yeah. You can invite 3 authors, living or dead. Who's coming?
Okay, my first invitation would be to J.K. Rowling. I've never met J.K. Rowling. I'm a huge admirer of J.K. Rowling. Both as a writer, what she has achieved in terms of getting so many children reading over the years. I think none of us know who is going to stand the test of time, but I'm pretty sure 100, 200, 300 years from now, she'll still be there. And I really respect her voice in the world and how she uses it. And I would just love to be in a room with her. So J.K. Rowling.
All right.
And I imagine she'd bring a good bottle with her as well.
I reckon she would.
You know. So first, J.K. Rowling.
What kind of bottle would, just in case she's downloaded the podcast?
Oh, something champagne, a nice bottle of Dom.
Dom Perignon.
Bottle of Dom.
Okay.
You know, I think she could afford it.
Vintage Dom Perignon?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Yeah, I mean, she can shell out. Come on. Yeah. She's got a few quid.
Of all the authors,
of all the authors who could be listening to this, she is the one who could afford some vintage Dom Perignon.
Yes, if you are listening, Joe, please come to my house for dinner with a bottle of vintage Dom.
Okay, she's the first one.
Okay. Second one would be Malcolm Bradbury. Malcolm Bradbury died in 2000, but he was my teacher in UEA when I was a student there in 94 and 95, when I was studying on the creative writing course. And I published my first novel only 2 months before he died. And he died very young. He died at 68. And he was a lovely man. He was a terrific writer. I loved his novels. I had read his novels way before I met him. He was very helpful on the course. He was really wise and cared about his students. And I would have liked to have the opportunity for him to see that I had gone on to, you know, make a career out of this. Every year on that course, you know, there would be so many students, but there was always this knowledge that only a certain percentage would make it effectively. And I would have liked to have the opportunity to tell him that I was one of them. So, Malcolm.
Okay. So, Malcolm Bradbury, J.K. Rowling.
Okay. And my third choice would be E.M. Forster. E.M. Forster was probably my favorite kind of classical, you know, classic writer of that period. But I've always been fascinated as a gay man about the fact that, you know, he had Morris hid under the bed for, you know, metaphorically speaking, for 60 years, you know, and wasn't published until 1971 after he died. And of course, he had a somewhat tortured life, I suppose, as a gay man in the times when it was illegal to, well, not to be gay, but to do anything gay, I suppose. I've always been interested in him. I loved the six novels that he published. I've gone back to them many, many times, and I'm not a big rereader, but I've read Howard's End two or three times, Room with a View two or three times, Where Angels Fear to Tread, and Morris, you know, I've read maybe four times. So I would like to sit down with him and tell him how times have changed, how life has changed, how it's, you know, we can write books about gay characters and be gay. You know, in Ireland, we have a gay prime minister, gay Taoiseach. So tell him that times are better, but also maybe to hear about his story.
He'd be somewhat surprised by the way Ireland is in 2023, wouldn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of Irish people are surprised. You know, it was 1992 before homosexuality was decriminalised. I was in university at the time. And yet we still became the first country in the world to actually vote for equal rights marriage. All in the space of, what was it, 23 years. It's a blink of an eye in history.
Boomtown Rats did Banana Republic, or Banana Republic is the way Bob Geldof used to sing it. And that was a hit record. And now when
give us your money.
That's right. But now if you play Banana Republic and you said that's about the Republic of Ireland, people go, well, it doesn't sound like the way it is now.
Yeah.
Because he wrote about Ireland as a banana republic run by police and priests.
Yeah, and it was. But it's changed enormously, and it's changed for the better. It's a really good country to live in now.
I just very quickly, of those three writers you mentioned, and I'm sure you'll get this straight away, one of them does or used to order the books by colour on their bookcase.
Do you know that?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Let me guess. I think it's probably going to be E.M. Forster.
J.K. Rowling.
Really?
Yeah. Yep. So there you go.
How do you know that?
Because I go around her house. No, because she's talked about it before.
She
does a bookcase by colour.
But now she's going to listen to this podcast.
Yeah.
And she's going to rearrange and design by geography.
Yeah.
Water is the new book from John Boyne. It's published by Doubleday. It's out now. Remember, if you want to get in touch with us, you can email anytime booksoftheyear@yahoo.com or via socials. We'll be back next week. John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Matt, thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to you as well. Yeah,
all right.